that he put forth the Empowering Patients First Act is the cruel hoax to call a law that is going to disempower vulnerable people such as older people, Medicaid recipients, and all of the extra 10, 20 million people who got health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. What it does instead is return to the old days, not only with people who benefit from the Affordable Care Act, who will now face exclusion or unaffordable high premiums once the Affordable Care Act is repealed. So as a physician, as a person, he isn't compassionate. He does not adhere to the ethics of the medical profession, which has first, do no harm. He is a secretary of HHS who will orchestrate and quarterback harm to the most vulnerable people in this country, and he should be opposed for that reason, in addition to these yet unanswered questions about his treating the healthcare industry, a $3.2 billion industry, the biggest industry in the country, as a business, making money as he can off of it, unanswered questions about whether he used information that he had to make these investments. The whole picture, his voting record, the law that he sponsored, the Empowering Patients First Act, and what he's doing in terms of the stock market, raise questions about
Dr.
someone
Wolf,
even...
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us, Dr. Sidney Wolf, Director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. And that does it for today's show. Very happy birthday to Edith Penty, and special thanks to Hafa Petri of ThoughtWorks. Today, his last day. We will be broadcasting for 8 hours tomorrow from 8 Eastern Time to 3 from the inauguration, and on Saturday, 10 to 3, covering the Women's March on Washington, D.C. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Good morning. It's 8:01. Coming up next, Voices from the Edge. Joanne will speak with Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill about the enforcement disparity on TriMet and the county's decision to stop prosecuting fair jumpers. Plus, a visit from organizer Margaret Jacobson from the Portland Women's March. That's next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Next Level, a benefit dance party on Saturday, January 21st, after the Women's March, starting at 8 p.m. at the Jade Club in Portland. This 21 and over event features Jen O of Strange Babes, KBOO's DJ Anjali, and Casual Aztec, as well as performances and more. Again, that's Next Level, a benefit dance party on Saturday, January 21st at 8 p.m. at the Jade Club, 315 Southeast 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the opening reception of Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. This event was originally scheduled for Friday, January 13th. Giving Back illustrates Black philanthropic experiences and giving traditions grounded in faith, mutuality, responsibility, and social justice. Images and stories are from the book Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African American philanthropists. Again, that's the opening reception of Giving Back, The Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your...
Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It's my pleasure to have in the studio with me Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill. And I learned something as I was checking him out, Googling him. He's been at Multnomah County since 1987. He started as a certified law student there. He has won many awards in his time at Multnomah County. I should also say that he has been district attorney until you, I'm sorry, let me back up. So he started in 87. He served as a deputy prosecutor from 1988 to 2007 and as chief deputy from 2007 until he took the office of district attorney January 1st, 2013. And I wanted to say that he has received lots of awards, including the Oregon Department of Public Safety and Standards, Commendation, Oregon Domestic Violence Council in 2010, the U.S. District Court of Oregon Historical Society honored Rod as one of Oregon's distinguished trial attorneys. He currently serves on many boards and commissions, including one that he and I serves on together, which is the Avell Gordley Center for Healing. We're both on the advisory committee. He also serves on All Hands Raised Council, the Multnomah Bar Association Professionalism Committee, and he's Multnomah County's Local Public Safety Coordinating Council Executive Committee member and co-chair of the Youth and Gang Violence Subcommittee. I could continue to read his resume, or I could actually talk to the district attorney. Welcome to the studio, Rod Underhill.
Thank you very much, Joanne. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited to participate with the conversation with you today.
Well, I thank you very much. And for those of you listening, I know you may have a question or two. Feel free to give us a call at 503-231-8187. And so I think we should really start with the basic. What is the job of the district attorney?
Well, the job of the district attorney is to help address in a fair and balanced way public safety around Multnomah County. We actually, while that's the focus of the office and the people that I work with in my office and our partners here, we also, I think, have a footprint in the state and hopefully in a positive way, helping to shape the state as it relates to public safety. And then I also participated at a national level with the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. So we have what I think is a helpful, beneficial kind of broad footprint in the area of public safety.
Hmm. And of course, over the last year, there have been many reports that have come out and talked about whether it's the jail population or use of force and some new programs and projects that you're working on statewide. And so we'll take those one at a time.
Great.
And again, if you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So I became aware of a report that came out, I believe, at the end of 2015, September 2015, which was an audit about the Multnomah County jail system and kind of who was in it. And I always get surprised when I read the data, right, the statistics, because I know in Multnomah County, the African-American population is 7%.
Correct.
And about. So it says that the Multnomah County jail population, based on this report, was 27%. Which you go, whoa, you know, that's like a lot in a city with only 7% population. And then the use of force cases they found were 39% as it related to the African-American community. So what do you make of that?
Well, no doubt you're referring to the MacArthur report.
Yes,
that was
that's
done.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. A very, very important critical report. It's shaping a lot of the work that we're doing here in Multnomah County. And I think it's expanding beyond Multnomah County with some of the things that we're doing as they are being looked at around the rest of the state as maybe some good ideas and good directions to help make a more fair and just system. So
and
more
to
detail
credit,
to that.
I was going to say, to your credit, though, you did say we have to take this and we have to do something with it,
yes.
Right? Unlike the former sheriff who said didn't want to do anything with the report. So it looks like there's some ongoing work to actually address these issues. There's committees.
There are, Joanne. We, my office and me personally, we took that report and we sunk our teeth into it. Mm-hmm. And first, we wanted to make sure that we understood it. We participated in supplying the data and some of the assessments. So it wasn't a complete surprise that the report came out. But I think all of us who reviewed the report carefully were troubled at many different points and wanted to first understand it.
Right.
Then real, and when I say understand it, I mean deep research, because this was a systemic view, kind of from a arrest through disposition.
Right.
And it looked at seven decision points within that analysis. And so we looked at each of the decision points. It's accurate to say that your prosecutor's office, my office, has a significant touch point on all of those decision points. We just do.
Right.
While at the same time, there are certain decision points which were much more prominent for us. For example, at the arrest point, that's more going to be your local law enforcement. But as we'll talk about here in a bit, some of my policy decisions in concert with conversations with local law enforcement can help shape their thinking about who's going to get arrested.
That's right.
So while they have more of a – local law enforcement certainly has more of a role in that arrest procedure, I, on the other hand, once it's submitted to the office of the district attorney at the review for prosecution, hey, by and large, that's us predominantly. That's where we are most, you know, the point guard in this conversation. And so we, I could keep going, but I'll kind of make the point now that each of those decision points, we had to look, we had to do a deeper dive about what's our role. We have a role in all of them. What's a deeper role that we can begin to make some adjustments and some change and some ideas? Some of them within the, our own office with policy, and then some of them in partnership with other public safety community members like local law enforcement, for example, to come up with a better practice. And that's where some of these projects that we're working on comes from, is that lean in, I like to think, and taking it extremely seriously and wanting to check how we do work and see if we can do it better.
I found it interesting. I did go through that report and review both the recommendations from the consultants as well as some of the recommendations that came from the sheriff. And so it's interesting to me that, yes, we're going to put systems in place to, like, check to make sure that we are, in fact, having an impact. And I guess my question is, from the public perspective, how will we know when those numbers are changing? I mean, what's going to be different at the front end in your office so that the public can see that those numbers are really going to have an impact?
Well, I think some very positive news, despite this being a very troubling document, the positive news is what we do with it as we move forward. And one of the very positive things that I think answers this question is our local chair, Deborah Cafori, and the commissioners. Certainly, we have three new commissioners, but I have little doubt that they want to continue to support the notion that we're going to check. We're going to do our own. MacArthur has. They haven't left our jurisdiction, but they're doing other work.
Right.
But we have research and data analysts that are going to continue to look into this very those seven decision points as we move forward. And we're going to be reporting to the chair and commissioners in open forum. In fact, we had one scheduled for December 13th, but it got postponed.
Yes.
We've had some other issues.
Right.
Yeah. But we want to report back and look at those decision points and see, are we implementing projects, policies, ideas that are making a more positive impact on some of those decision points as it relates to disproportionality.
Right.
That's a good thing. That keeps us all involved. We can't let this opportunity and momentum that we have now, especially now in our both our community and our country, now more than ever, we need to work hard and double down on this kind of idea. Anyway, we'll be reporting to the public every year, right?
Excellent. We're going to go to the phone line. Good morning, Richard. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Thank you
for taking my call, and good morning, Mr. Underhill. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Pete, I have a different slant on things. I'm concerned about the apparent discrimination against in favor of high-ranking people who take out stalking orders based on a single contact that causes no alarm, which of course is a class C class A felony. No, I'm sorry, class C felony, and hindering, simulating legal process. Right. I sent you a copy of a numbered sworn statement, numbered paragraph sworn statement about Catherine Brown, who took out such a stalking
order. So, excuse me, we're not going to do this.
How does that instill confidence in the public's mind when you apparently have lost that document that was served on your office 2 years ago?
So I'm going to ask you to call the DA's office and...
Well, it doesn't do any good. It doesn't do any good, Joanne, and I really appreciate the opportunity to...
But I don't want you using somebody's name. We don't know anything about the case other than what you're telling us.
There's no information about it except for a case number. Catherine Brown did it.
Okay.
It's all right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Underhill. You can have a good one.
I don't think it's appropriate for us to talk about an individual case that somebody has with the DA's office, because most of the time other people need to have their lawyers present as well. And so that's why I'm stopping that conversation. So is there another caller that we have? Good morning, Ron. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
All right. Also, I want to say, right under here, I think you're really an amazing person. For the things you're trying to do, and also for just moving forward on that report. I think that's really, really good. And also, I was just hoping that you might be able to talk about the LEAD program and how's that moving forward.
Great.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because that was on my list as well.
Yes. Thank you, Ron. And Joanne and I have every intention of probably diving deep into the LEAD program. So I look forward to having that conversation. We can do it now or as you see fit, Joanne.
As we move on, but we will make sure to get it in before this program's over.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Ron.
I do want to, before we get to the LEAD program, I'm very excited about this new initiative. My understanding, see if I got this right, because I'm not always right, is that you, Multnomah County District Attorney, Washington County, and Clackamas County have collectively come together and started looking at these transit-related crimes, right? And what did you call it, TIP?
We called it, the acronym is IPT.
IPT.
It stands for, the criminal title is Interference with Public Transportation.
Yes.
So the acronym is IPT.
And didn't we just pass that recently in Salem? Like, wasn't that a bill that passed like within the last four or five years?
Short answer is yes. I think it was probably a little bit longer than that.
Okay.
But it's in that window of time where IPT became a Class A misdemeanor here in the state of Oregon, recently passed, relatively recently, by the legislature. So you want me to go ahead and talk
Please.
A little bit about that?
Please.
So, Joanne, and actually it harkens back to the Red Report done by MacArthur. So I'll tie it into that because that's some of the value of this report is my office, myself and my office, one of the areas when I talked about kind of diving deep is to understand what crime categories. So we see disparity across the board relative to the public safety and individuals of color being arrested at a disproportionate rate. But are there areas, are there crime categories where we see even a higher disproportionality than others, for example? And so that's the value of MacArthur is it helped us frame our thinking of it, but then, we dove deep into it. Mm. One of the areas, for example, where we saw a disproportionate rate higher than most was in the area of these IPTs, interference with public transportation. Another is going to be in possession of controlled substances, and we'll come back around to that as we talk about LEAD. Okay. So as it relates to the IPT, MacArthur helped us to deeply study and begin, because I began with an approach of, well, where do we start? We want to start, and I'm going to overly simplify it with, we want to start where we're seeing the most disproportionality.
Right.
And look at those policies and practices and come up with, challenge ourselves with, can we come up with good ideas that are better than where we are? So it's with that kind of, framework that we began to look deeply at the IPT, what makes up an IPT, what the disproportionality is, and then have conversations with partners about, can we make good change, a better idea for tomorrow? So what we learned, I'll attempt to summarize it. what we learned is within the IPT kind of crime category, there are really two different, there are two subcategories. Let me give you some numbers to give you a sense of the volume that we see. In any calendar year, in any 12-month period of time, my office receives about 600. We looked at three different years. We looked at 14, 15, and 16 data, essentially. And we see about 600 of these cases a year that come to the office. They come in as Class A misdemeanors. And when we talk about a Class A misdemeanor, that is somebody who is subject to an arrest and custody. They are subject to being taken to jail and oftentimes are. They're not necessarily staying in jail a long time, although some do. But we looked at those 600, and then within those 600, we teased out essentially two subcategories. One is somebody gets arrested for behavioral conduct. They're doing scary things, right? Maybe they're hurting somebody. They're pushing, shoving. They can even be assaulting somebody. So that's going to be in a, I'm going to put it in the behavioral category. Mm-hmm. And then there's another category, and that's the, overly summarize it by saying a fare evading category, mm-hmm. where you're on the train, you've been excluded previously, maybe for a fare evading, and you're on the train again without a fare. That is about 400 of the about 600. I'm using some pretty rough numbers, but it's pretty close. So it's a very significant portion are in the fare evading category. So we took a deeper dive about, first, the disproportionality within each of those two subcategories. Frankly, what we saw was we saw similarity, high disproportionality in both of those categories. But all of us are most troubled, I guess, and deserved a deeper look in the fare evading. Behavioral, we want people to be safe on MAX. We want people to be safe, feel safe. And so we really put our focus on the fare evading, which also was about two-thirds of what we tended to see. And so we looked at several things. First, there was a significant disproportionality, and we wanted to do better by that. That felt wrong. Second, Class A misdemeanor relative to the notion of someone being arrested and prosecuted by a local prosecutor's office for a Class A misdemeanor, even if you chose to reduce them, you still didn't change the arrest on the MAX train, right? And all of those attendant circumstances before it ever gets to my desk. And we looked at, should a fare evasion be from a punitive sanction, should it be the same as domestic violence, misdemeanor domestic violence, where, you know, family violence of very serious conduct and other forms of, you know, Class A misdemeanor? Short answer is no. We thought that that was a disproportionate response. And so I worked with John Foote over in Clackamas County. I reached out, talked to him about the work that we were looking in, what we were finding, and he was very interested in joining with looking at Clackamas County's, because MAX, of course, goes into Clackamas County. Same with Bob Herman over in Washington County. So the three of us began, I would say, continued conversations about what I was learning, and they started looking at and seeing some of the same things. We're also working with TriMet and their leadership and talking to them about alternatives. And they were very interested in wanting to explore alternatives because they too were troubled by what we were finding. And simultaneously, they were having Portland State look at the more upstream aspect of that, what I'm trying to summarize. They look at the upstream, PSU did, whereas we looked at the once arrested and then further downstream. So they wanted to do better by that. So the good news was we were able to bring the MacArthur report, really that red report, was the spark to a deeper dive into that area and legitimate action to us wanting to first call out and recognize a high disproportionality area in a crime category, if you will. And then believing as we look closely at that, that first we were bothered by the disproportionality and the disproportionality of the punitive sanction response to it, whatever the demographic of the person is. And so we made an adjustment that we think is an extremely positive one. By from a numbers standpoint, we'll only know as we move forward, but out of those, say, 400, we expect that number to drop to maybe 10% of that. So in other words, 40, and frankly, I think that's probably even a little high. It may be less than that are going to be coming to my office as we move forward in the next 12 months, say.
And so is there training, retraining that needs to take place with TriMet fare inspectors, with Portland police who are called to TriMet to handcuff and take people off trains for not paying their fares? I mean, how does that really become institutionalized at the front end, right? Because by the time it gets to your office, it's already too late, right? Because, especially if they've been handcuffed and they're already in jail waiting for you to decide how you're going to prosecute the case. What happens at the front end? How do we make sure that police and fair inspectors really understand this new change philosophy?
Well, so what I don't know, what I won't be able to sit here and talk about is some of the deeper details about TriMet's thinking. I can tell you, first, I understand the question. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I had the same conversation with them.
Right.
And I can report back that they are extremely interested in wanting to do better in this area. Mm-hmm. And to the extent there's implicit bias that may be occurring on MAX trains as it relates to fare inspectors and who not just gets contacted, because as we learned, I think everybody gets contacted, but it's what's the response to the contact. Mm. If this person doesn't have a fare and that person doesn't have the fare, do they get the same response?
Yes, yes.
And so TriMet is extremely interested in wanting to do better by that. Mm. So I can only believe, because here's where I don't know the details. Right. I only believe based on the conversation I have that training is part of what they have envisioned as they move forward to begin to tackle that. But they're going to be better at answering the details of that.
Yes, I was going to say I will check in with them with that question. I think that is an unfair question for you. But it's interesting because my experience over the last year at having a fare inspector come. Now, I'm an old woman in comparison to the people that they normally approach. Me and another woman, MAX train late at night. Four very big, scary, intimidating looking men who said they were fare inspectors came and demanded our tickets. Mine was on my phone, so it was relatively easy for me to get mine. But I thought to myself, if I was a 17, 18, 19-year-old young girl, and I had these four men surround me while they demand my ticket, the intimidation factor alone would cause me to act inappropriately just because of fear, right? And I thought, and I asked them, I said, does it really take all four of you to ask for fare? Well, we travel in teams, which is what I hear from the Portland Gang Enforcement Unit, right? But I think it's important that your office gets to see it from the other side, as well as TriMet and the other agencies involved. So I just wanted to share that with you. It was
Thank
a
you.
Very interesting experience.
And this, maybe I can kind of wrap this part up. I mean, certainly subject to more questions if you have some. But I'll tie it back into the Red Report, because this was an area where I challenged both myself and my office, but then also reached out to Clackamas County and Washington County Prosecutor's Office as this notion of can we as a district attorney's offices, plural now, have an impact that actually gets upstream of where we typically are, right, with suggesting and actually helping to guide policy that actually will occur on the train itself as opposed to on our lawyer's desk. And so that's where we looked at that Red Report. And where we see the disproportionality, the most prominent disproportionality starts at that arrest point.
That's right.
And then continues. It goes, you know, it begins at just above a 4-to-1 RRI ratio. And then it continues across the spectrum for the most part. So can we as prosecutors help get upstream and have conversations that are at that initial arrest stage? And this is an area, as is lead when we get to that. This is an area where we wanted to get upstream and help all of us look for a better and more fair system.
Thank you. If you're just joining the conversation, I'm talking to Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill, and we're talking about a lot of stuff, including the Red Report. We're going to get to LEAD, and we're talking in acronyms, but I'm going to stop that and say the Racial Equity Report. That was a study of Multnomah County jails and has a whole lot of really good information about who's there, how they get there, and we're talking about how to get as few people there as possible. And we're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Ross. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you so much for doing this program.
You're welcome.
And this focus is very timely for me. I have a friend, and I want to say first to preface that I do not know nothing about the exact paperwork or immigration status of my dear friends, but I have I have immediate experience. This afternoon, I'm going to go down to Multnomah County Court with a friend who lives out on about 60th and Gleason. He takes the train every day to his work. He has a good job, and he buys his fare and comes in. One day, the fare machine, this is according to him, of course,
right,
did not work, and he got on the train, and bang, some guy gave him a ticket.
Right.
He said the machine didn't work, and so he's going. I'm going to go with him today, this afternoon, to court to see what happens. But I want to say that before that, it wasn't too long ago that I have a friend from Peru, who was going someplace, heading towards Clackamas. And see, I took her down to Oregon City to go to court. Her fine was $300. $300.
Whoa, for $200. I mean, for $2.50 fare.
Pardon me?
For $2.50 fare, the fine for not paying it was $300.
$300. I told her to tell those people to go to.
Now. You're on a video.
My attitude. I say, no, this is not right.
Mm.
But for some reason, some immigrant people, they maybe don't speak the language so well, but they don't want to fight. They will do anything. They will pay all their fares. They pay the fare. And then, so this is what I was going to say is I'll call back maybe next Thursday and let you know what happens in court this afternoon. But
please.
I'm concerned to know if this policy is in effect, do I have any hope that this fellow will escape?
Is it retroactive, is what you're saying?
Without a $300 fine?
I'll give the district attorney a chance to answer that. Thank you so much for your call.
You.
And thank you for standing up with your friends. I mean, it takes all of us to actually maneuver this whole system that we have.
Well, I've had the same situation, but I'm telling you, I'm a nice white liberal. and I have never been stopped by anybody, whether I had a ticket or whether I didn't.
Oh, wait. Let me ask you again now. Have you ever got a ticket from a fare inspector for not having?
No.
Okay.
No.
Have they ever asked you?
At least once I must have been on a, because if I get on there and I can't get the fare, I get on that train.
You are not the only one. But I'm not going to admit to any criminal behavior.
If I were an immigrant and I couldn't get a driver's license, I'd be on the train for sure.
That's true. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
We'll give the DA
a chance to respond. So what's your advice to this gentleman?
Hey, well, thanks for the call. And sounds like your friend has a good ally in his and her camp. So a couple of key things in there that I want to point out. So as it relates to IPT, that interference with public transportation, and when my office becomes involved, it sounds to my ears like it's not at the point where you're referring to. That's that initial citation for a first offense. IPT only gets activated essentially after a person has been excluded already from the MAX train for a predicate incident.
Mm-hmm.
So that predicate incident sometimes, as we found out in the fare evading analysis, was often a previous fare evasion.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a person gets on MAX, doesn't have a fare. That fare inspector has a continuum of options.
Mm-hmm.
One is issue a warning. Two is issue a citation, but think of it more like a traffic citation.
Mm-hmm.
And the district, your local district attorney's office is not involved in that aspect of things. And then that fare inspector has a third option, that is exclusion in addition to one of those other two options. So my office becomes involved in the area of IPTs after that exclusion is in place and think of it like a subsequent trespass onto the MAX, right? That's the premise behind it. So I'm guessing, based on your summary, that maybe my office isn't involved in the aspect that you're referring to because it sounds more like that first contact. But here's another point that you raised that I think is a good one that's worth commenting on. So my office, because you, Joanne, you referred to the retroactively applying some of this.
Right.
Upon the date that we announced this new policy moving forward, I simultaneously asked my office staff to let's find out all of the IPT cases that currently are in our system.
Right.
And today, even though those individuals, community members, were not arrested and subject to the policy at the time, but let's retroactively apply our policy to those that are currently in the system. So in other words, if it's a case that we would not issue today, but we issued it yesterday, really a month
ago.
6 months
ago, right.
If we wouldn't issue it today, let's dismiss it. And so we've been cleaning those out, right? And actually, I should probably double check now that I've just said that out loud to make sure that we have finished that process. But we instituted that right away.
Wonderful. Love to check back up on that. So let's talk a little bit about LEED before we go back to the phone lines.
Sure.
Tell our listeners, what is LEED and what will it do to change our criminal justice system?
Okay. Very good. Well, so once again, LEED is, I think, one of the catalysts, not the catalyst, but one of the catalysts goes back again to the RED report conducted by MacArthur. It contributed to, it was a variable. Mm. I'd been kind of carefully watching the LEED program as it was, LEED was formed up in Seattle.
Yes.
It began in 2011 in King County, Washington, which essentially is primarily Seattle is its base. LEED was the product of, they were having federal litigation over the disproportionality of individuals of color being arrested for possession of controlled substance. Mm-hmm. They call it a different acronym.
Right.
I think it's VUSCA or something like that.
Right.
But anyway, it's the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
People who are abusing or addicted to controlled substances being contacted and then arrested for that possession of that controlled substance.
Right.
They had a high disproportionality, and essentially the city was being sued because of it. This was, and I'm overly simplifying it as I understand it, but this was a product of how do we resolve this litigation and what can we come up with that has a better answer as we move forward?
Right.
And so that promulgated LEED. Now, LEED is an acronym for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. Mm. So LEED is premised on a couple of very big umbrella concepts. One is it's a harm reduction model as it relates to drug abuse and addiction. Mm-hmm. That's different than abstinence, and I wouldn't consider myself an expert. There are experts that can describe this better. I think I'm pretty conversant about it, so I'll take a stab at it. But a harm reduction model is a notion where you're going to meet the individual where they are.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to work with them where they are. You're going to look at successes in a individualized basis. And it doesn't necessarily require success being abstinence from the controlled substance, which is a lot of the historical premises by the criminal justice system.
Right.
You know, we have this community has, pardon me, a long, rich history of drug diversion and treatment courts, and they were awesome and have been awesome for what we were. But I think we're learning more as we move on, and that's the flexibility that a society and a criminal justice system needs to have is. Do we need to insist on abstinence in order to claim success in an area? Right. Or can we work instead with this harm reduction model?
Mm-hmm.
So it begins with that premise, but then really some of the most critical aspects of it include this notion that at the point of contact by law enforcement, when law enforcement either gets called to an area because of open air drug use or encountered as they're patrolling the streets or walking the streets, as they encounter what is to them, the use of, say, under one of our bridges. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of a dose of reality of sometimes what law enforcement sees all too often is an open air drug injection, right, under one of our bridges of heroin. And contact and an arrest scenario and a gathering of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
LEED is still going to have those events occur. However, the critical part where LEED differentiates itself from every other program that we've ever done in Multnomah County is at that time where that officer is concluding their quote-unquote investigation, the individual that they're talking to, subject to a modest exclusion list, but the individual that they're talking to is going to be given an option of the next step in this process, sir or ma'am, right, is I'm going to be taking you to jail and lodging you for this felony crime of possession of a controlled substance. Or, and here's where the difference is, or I'd like to offer you an option of me calling a case manager to come work with you to essentially take care and custody of you right now and work with you about your needs as they exist today.
Mm.
We're going to assign this case manager to you for an indefinite period of time to help work with you on what your needs are. Because what we found, what Seattle found, we've studied it, I've studied it carefully and became a believer in feeling that it was a good program for this community at this time. Mm. For a handful of reasons, one being we do see from the RED report done by MacArthur a disproportionate number of communities of color being contacted and arrested for possession of controlled substances. That was one of those crime categories that jumped out to me when we began to do that deep dive. And so I was aware of the LEAD program. I was aware that they were studying it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that it worked before we move forward on it. Mm-hmm. Dan Satterberg is my peer up in King County, Washington. Dan and I are colleagues and friends. I've talked to him lots about it. I've gone up to Seattle. I've watched their program for a couple of different days. Mm-hmm. And I become convinced that we should move forward with that. Mm. And what back to the differences. So what we're really talking about is, let's assume, and we hope that the answer is, yes, I want to go with a case manager much more frequently than that jail door.
Right.
That's going to change the trajectory of hundreds of people in a year, right? Hundreds of individuals in a year as we pilot this project are going to have a different experience and a different opportunity. They're going to be able to be assigned to a case manager who's going to be an expert in the harm reduction philosophy and ideas. They're going to work with the person to, if you're using a gram a day of a particular type of controlled substance, we're going to work with you in next week, can we report that it's a little less than a gram? And a month from now, can it be down to a half a gram? And I know I've spent all my time talking about the controlled substance aspect of it, but if our demographics resemble Seattle's, we're going to see 7 or 8 of the individuals out of our pilot project area are going to be simultaneously homeless.
That's
as
right.
well.
Right.
And so this case manager needs to work with that person on that aspect. We're also going to see that 3 out of 10 are going to be women. It's a crime category where women are much more prominent than many other crime categories that we see.
Right.
So we need to be aware of the needs of a woman as she walks through these challenges,
right.
As opposed to a man, because they are sometimes different.
Yeah.
We need to look at the mental health aspects. We're going to see individuals that have a mental health overlay,
right.
sometimes in addition to a drug abuse or addiction issue, in addition to homeless. And so these case manager is going to be tasked with some heavy burdens
yes.
to help us navigate this.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking time to kind of lay out it as simply as possible, because I know we're going to be learning as this process gets fully implemented. And I think one of the questions for me as you were talking is I was thinking, well, so the people that say no, is that their last chance? I mean, right? So, so let's just assume that half the people think, oh, yeah, right, this cop's like really trying to help me, right? And they say no.
Correct.
Because they're thinking, well, you know, I could spend a day with these folks and then go back to life as normal, right? Or now they're going to connect me to somebody that's going to hound me for the rest of my days, right? Is there, if they say no, does anybody ever go back a day or so later and say, how do you think about this now?
So a person can say no, because it is going to be a voluntary
choice. System, yes.
I'll follow that person through. I'll come circle back and I'll follow that person through with their no choice at the front end.
Okay.
But before I do that, let me jump. Let's say a week from that no,
right.
a week later,
right.
that person is out in the community
right.
and the event occurs again.
Right, right.
Once you say no, is it a no forever?
Right.
And the answer to that question is no.
Is no.
They're going to be offered that opportunity likely again. This is where we're still working out some of the logistics of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little clunky currently, but this is why we're working hard on this area. But the first no, what happened then?
Right.
That person was, taken to jail. They did their recog. Most individuals that are charged with this user level amount are not staying in custody very long and often recogged.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of variables that goes into that, but I'm trying to put them into big categories.
Right.
But what does happen for sure is that case is submitted to my office for prosecution review. We review it and issue it if all the attendant elements are met and such. But here's where another program that my office put together and has in consultation with lots of other partners, we're calling it Treatment First Program.
Mm-hmm.
So What I've done is I've summarized LEAD, but I've also commented on it's a pilot, mm-hmm. and it's also several hundred individuals. So we mm-hmm. have a geographic area. Mm-hmm. We've got to pilot it. That's what Seattle did. They did it in the Belltown region. They worked out a lot of the kinks, mm-hmm. see, you know, determine right. if it works.
Right.
That's what we're doing. But as we've looked at the numbers, there's about 1,500 other cases throughout the rest of the county that I believed we needed to do better by as well. Uh-huh. And so that's a treatment first program. Mm. Meeting every week with Judge Jones and a number of other judges and system partners in his courtroom as we try to figure out how to overhaul our system
right.
on the rest of the county, and it would include the people that say no.
Mm-hmm.
So that person that said no, when it hits my desk, what do I want to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Today, you know, the crime is a felony level crime.
Right.
What I'm saying is, let's lower the temperature in the room. That's maybe a bad phrase, but let's take the punitive nature out of this and mm-hmm. let's bring it down a notch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wanting to charge these as Class A misdemeanors. I'm running to bring it down from a felony. Felonies have a lot of collateral consequences.
Yes.
Bring it down to a Class A misdemeanor. In most all instances, there's mm-hmm. going to be an exclusion category, although it's going to be a modest one.
Right.
But bring it down to a Class A misdemeanor. Enter the person into a tailored treatment program tailored to their needs. We want to do a risk and needs assessment on that person. What do they need? And then if they go into the program and complete mm-hmm. it, we'll dismiss the misdemeanor. So a person, that person that said no,
right.
that's the trajectory that I envision. We're not quite there yet. It's right. a work in progress.
Right.
We're also hoping to begin that program within the next few months. We're mm-hmm. trying to get it together. We've been meeting aggressively and we got some, you know, things to work on.
Yes.
But I keep pushing and I want to get it going here in a few months right. so that that person that said no, they didn't go to the case manager and they didn't get completely diverted from the court system in my office.
Right.
But they experienced a tremendously different experience in the system. First, they got charged as a misdemeanor instead of a felony.
Right.
Second, I'll dismiss that misdemeanor with compliance with the program needs that are meant to help them, actually. And then we'll
I'm going to have you come back after the program starts so that we yes. can, you know, talk about like what you're seeing directly in Portland. I still have questions about just the law enforcement approach, right? What if the contracted service provider was the one that made the initial approach, right? Because to me, it still feels a bit big brothery to have the police saying you've got one of two options, right?
I got a good response to you, Joanne.
Please,
because we've saw that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have both this vehicle that will be a law enforcement inserted vehicle. That's okay. the one I've summarized.
Mm-hmm.
But you brought up what we call a social contact
yes.
insertion into the LEAD program.
Yes,
we have that available. So that case manager,
uh-huh.
who Joe is a longtime drug abuser or addicted has needs that
right.
need to be met.
Right.
But do we need to wait for Joe to literally be caught injecting?
Yes.
That doesn't make a lot of sense, does
right.
it?
Right.
No is the answer. That's where a person, you, me, that case manager on the street, somebody mm-hmm. works for Mercy Corps, anybody can call LEAD and say, Joe's ready mm-hmm. to try and take advantage of the services, the case manager services that LEAD has to offer. Is there a place for him in the room? Right. And I hope the answer is going to be yes more than it is ever no.
It's very exciting to hear that the DA is really thinking about a harm reduction model, trying to implement one that makes sense for this community. These are exciting times. I do think that I appreciate the fact that we are rethinking our criminal justice system and who it serves and how it serves and how we can make it better. And so I'd love to have you back in about 6 months after we've had a little time on the street here and see how that program worked. Thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it. I know time goes fast.
It did go fast.
This hour
Joanne.
Goes pretty quick.
Yeah.
But I'm going to bring Margaret in, and her and I are going to talk a little bit about the Women's March, and which is coming up, of course, this Saturday. And we're certainly looking forward to having you back again at another time.
Great.
Thank you very much. Really,
Joanne,
appreciate
thank
it.
You. And thanks for your callers calling in and asking us some good questions.
Yes, they did.
All right. Thanks again, Joanne.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. And yes, I know that the KBOO listening audience has been calling in and asking and wondering what's going on with this Women's March and whether or not I had been in contact with the new organizers and what was the NAACP thinking and a whole bunch of stuff. And so this laughter that you're hearing is my sister from another mother, Margaret Jacobson, is that right?
Yeah.
Who is one of the organizers that stepped up. Mm-hmm. You know, people who don't know us would think you and I orchestrated some of the media coverage, right? And let us just say we didn't talk.
No.
Right? We didn't talk. This is our first face-to-face. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of email communications, but that was it. Mm-hmm. So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And so first, let me publicly say thank you very much. I've told you that over email, and you've repeated that to the media. And so tell me, where is the march right now?
Oh, goodness. It is. I mean, I think it's in a great place now. Mm. I think we've had a lot of very difficult conversations. We've made a lot of people uncomfortable. We've been hearing that we've hijacked it, and we're trying to push a new agenda, which is, you know, it's partially true. We are trying to change the message from simply being we're all one to we're all different and we can all still march together and we all matter. But we have to put in that work and recognize that. And I think that that is not necessarily what people were looking to do with their marching.
Yes.
But I'm kind of under, you know, like I believe that if we are going to be marching for something alongside people, then we have to be knowledgeable about all of their different narratives and experiences. And so I think it's okay to have some growing pains, which is what we've been experiencing for the last 2 weeks.
Yes. But next time you step up for a march. But I absolutely agree with you. And the NAACP did not take our decision to pull out of the march. Mm-hmm. As you know, it wasn't a overnight decision.
Nope.
It was after many, many conversations. Yep. It was after really talking directly to the organizers, trying to understand where they were coming from, and trying to broaden their worldview about why it was so important to include the women who are most under attack in our community. And I called them out and I was like, well, what about the immigrant and refugees? And well, what about Muslim women? And what about Black Lives Matters? And it's for all women. And so once I realized that I had hit a wall, and so that was code for making sure that white women would be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I realized I had reached this brick wall, that there was no ability for me to get around or go over or break down, I just had to back up. Now, I think the good thing that Portland shouldn't feel too bad.
Yeah.
Because we've heard this is also happening at the national level.
Yep. It is. It's, I mean, it was planned originally by a white woman, but then handed over to women of color to kind of help, because how would she know how to be inclusive without those voices? And it goes back to that thing of like, you have to bring everyone to the table in order to actually plan. You can't wait till way after the fact and add some people to appease folks. And so I think that I was aware of what was taking place when I was handed the organizing. And so.
And how did that happen? How did you of a sudden end up?
Yeah, you know, I had just kind of been in a conversation with someone who was doing, I think she's a representative for our state, who's taking people from Oregon to Washington. And she was really upset about what had happened. Mm-hmm. And she was like, how do I somehow just take the march from this person?
Right.
Because she's refusing to kind of to let go, if I'm going to be frank and honest about it.
Right.
And Planned Parenthood was really concerned because they were like, they were also on the fence about if they were going to support. And when I kind of entered the conversation, people were like, oh, maybe actually we can still have the march and you can kind of help redirect it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, sure, I would love this opportunity to bring all of these people that I get to work with to the table.
Right.
And then put that out into the community, because so many times Portland focuses on how we do have race issues. And while I agree with that, I'm also like, can you please also just give us an opportunity to just be and for all of us to be out there? And so I'm really excited that we actually get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a thing of like, I don't ever want to take anything from anyone. That planning was done and it was great, but it was harmful and it was hurtful. Mm-hmm. And now a lot of people feel safer.
Yes.
Some people are upset because there's discomfort.
Yes.
And they wanted to just march and feel good.
Right, right.
But what feel, you know, I feel like it feels much better to understand that we're actually being intersectional about things.
Yes.
And that we're hearing all these voices and that yes. people are sitting down and listening. To me, that feels better for me as a person of color, as a Black person. And I'm kind of done at this point with kind of sitting back and letting white people dictate how much space I can have and when I can enter. And so I'm kind of like, I hope that this march shows a side of Portland that I see and that I love and that I'm a part of and that I know that you are a part of and you also know. And so I think that a lot of people are confused by how I feel very comfortable with the NAACP's choice. And I'm like, why wouldn't I? I'm so proud of that, though. I'm so proud of that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, and I think that has been the biggest... And what's been interesting is there are two categories of people I've heard from over the last couple of weeks. There have been people who say, well, there's a woman of color leading it now, so why didn't NAACP rejoin? And then there are the people who say, thank you so much for forcing this conversation, for demanding equality, for demanding a seat at the table. And ironically, it breaks down along racial lines.
Yes.
So people of color are the ones that, no explanation necessary, they're just like, thank you, thank you, thank you. But on this side are progressive white Portlanders that still can't understand. And so I came up with an analogy recently that I gave to one of the media. And I said, well, that's like if I tell you that hitting me upside the head with your wood baseball bat hurts, and you go and get a plastic one and you keep hitting me upside the head, you're in your mind, well, I heard you. I incorporated what you said, but you're still hitting me upside the head, right?
Yes.
It's still hurting. The harm has not been removed, right?
No.
And so I am so grateful that you have stepped into this place. I know how difficult this has been because I've been watching and listening to all the madness that's been taking place. And so I do. I really appreciate the fact that you've stepped in and that you know who you are. So you're like really clear. Yeah. I was reading an interview that you did and I said, that's my sister. Yes. Yes. Look at that.
Yeah.
And so I wish that you and I had been early on involved in this effort because this would not have been controversial.
Oh my gosh. No, it wouldn't have been. And I'm just grateful because then now we get to have this conversation and we get to meet in the future.
Yes.
And obviously, and that's my favorite thing about the march. What we're trying to tell people is it's not done on Saturday. We're going to keep going and we're having you commit to volunteering and being a part of things and donating and showing up. That's what's expected.
And I want to definitely invite you to come to the march that I'm going to be involved with, which will happen the following Saturday, January 28th. We'll be meeting at the Dr. Martin Luther King statue at the Oregon Convention Center. We'll be marching to Maranatha Church.
Okay.
And we will have a community program, hot food, a community fair. So if you have organizations that you're trying to get people to sign up, it'll be a great place to do that.
Perfect.
And for one time only, we will be having the NAACP general meeting at Maranatha so that we can participate in the march. It's like almost never would I move an NAACP meeting. But this is one of those marches that started off with people of color saying, who's not here? Who do we need to bring before we get too far gone? Mm-hmm. And so I felt bad not having to pull out of the women's march, but I was heartened knowing that this other march was coming together.
Yeah.
And so as we know about Portland, we'll be marching throughout most of 2017.
Yeah.
And so I say come out, participate. As you know, I've never told anyone not to come to the Women's March. I'm like, you do what you need to do.
Come. It's up to you.
It's up to you, right? My name is Bennett. I'm not in it. But I so appreciate you, and I appreciate the strong stance that you've taken. And I hope we've been a model for the broader community know that even though you and I didn't talk, you and I share the same values about being inclusive and making sure every voice was heard and not at the exclusion of anyone.
Exactly. Thank you. I have, I'm just, I'm so grateful. So I'm grateful for what you did, and I'm very proud.
As am I. It is such a pleasure to meet you. I look forward to us working together. We're going to have some wonderful times in 2017. And thank you very much for being here today. I am Joanne Hardesty. You've been listening to Voices from the Edge. It's amazing how quickly this hour goes. But hey, that's just the way it goes. See you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a fabulous day.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good morning. It is 8:58. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's Thursday, January 19th. Coming up later this morning at 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program hosted by Teresa Mitchell. That's coming up in just about a minute. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fogarang takes your calls to discuss Trump, the CIA, and Russia. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, on Between the Covers, an outlaw activist on the run, a pipeline set to destroy a river, and three young women who must decide who to love, who to trust, and what to sacrifice. A conversation with Susan DeFreitas, the author of Hot Season. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, please become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:59, and Press Watch is next.
Good morning, honey. You old gloomy sight.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Lady Sings the Blues, showing Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. Diana Ross portrays jazz singer Billie Holiday in this biographical drama. The film depicts her early attempts at a singing career and her eventual rise to stardom, as well as her difficult relationships and drug addiction. Again, that's Lady Sings the Blues, Monday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses,